Hey guys, can I just have your attention for 1 minute? I'm part of the Harvard Real Estate Club, and in conjunction with OCS, we're putting forward a fantastic workshop tomorrow. And this workshop is really especially useful for seniors who's looking forward to start a career or graduate school in New York or West Coast. And the workshop will really help you to navigate the real estate market in West Coast and NYC. Mr. Jordan Cooper, class of 01. And the head of his own real estate relocation firm in New York will be leading the workshop and will answer all your questions about rent versus buying, charge considerations, so on and so forth. So especially for graduate seniors, this is going to be a fantastic workshop. And it's tomorrow at Le Mans Forum, first presentation at 5 p.m. and the second one at 6 p.m. for those who's writing senior honor exams. So that's tomorrow, Wednesday, first presentation at 5 p.m. and second one at 6 p.m. Hope to see all the class of 06 there. Thank you.
Hey guys, we're from the Seneca, and for those of you who don't know, the Red Party is this Thursday night. It's the largest club event at Harvard. Last year, 1,600 undergraduates came. This year, we're aiming for capacity, which is 2,000. It's at the Roxy from 10 to 2 a.m. We're being sponsored by Tommy Doyle's. There's a pregame there. Felipe is staying open extra late, so when you guys come back from the Red Party, you can still eat. And if you want tickets, get it from anyone wearing this sweatshirt or from email redparty2006@gmail.com. Thanks, guys.
Good morning. So let's talk about love. Let's talk about life. Let's talk about trust. Let's talk about love. Everyone talks about it. Relationships, sex. We're not going to talk about that today, are we? No. What is it? What is love? What are romantic relationships? What is it all about? E.E. Cummings wrote a beautiful poem. And here is Cameron Diaz reading that poem from the film In Her Shoes.
This isn't in the program, because it's a surprise. I surprise Rose a lot. Usually she hates it. I hope she likes this. It's a poem by E.E. Cummings. For you. I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful, you are my world, my true. Here is the deepest secret no one knows. Here is the root of the root, and the bud of the bud, and the sky of the sky, a tree called life, which grows higher than the soul can hope or mind can hide. It is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart.
Okay. and they lived happily ever after. What is this root of the root, bud of the bud, the thing that keeps the stars apart? What is this thing called love? This is what we're going to talk about for the next two lectures. It is probably the topic that's written about most, researched the most poems written about, most books written about it, and yet it is probably the most misunderstood of all topics. We're not going to get to the root of this topic in the next two lectures. We need much longer than that. But what I hope to do is to give you a sense of what psychology, positive psychology particularly, has to say about this wonderful emotion, which is not just an emotion. We're going to focus on romantic love. However, we're going to focus on it simply because it's the tip of the stem of all other relationships. What we're going to talk about to a great extent is going to apply to relationship between friends, parents and children, siblings. A lot of it is going to apply to that, but focus will be on romantic love. What are we going to do for the next two classes? First, we're going to talk about the need for relationships. Why it is such an important psychological need, why we all seek it, what are the reasons behind our needing it, and we're also going to be defining it. There are a lot of myths out there, to a great extent, because so much has been written about it for so long. So we're going to look at the research and what it can point to in terms of the facts about relationships. So for example, is love about self-sacrifice or self-interest? Does love wane over time? Or does it or can it grow with the years? Because after all, what do we see around us? 67% of couples divorce. That doesn't mean the other 33% have it good. So what does that mean? What does this tell us about love, about romantic relationships? Does true love only exist in movies? Or can it exist in our lives? We're going to approach it using the tip of the stem. We're going to look at highly successful relationships and ask ourselves, what can I learn from it? What can I learn from it and apply to my life? Just like we learned from Lama Osser, the meditator, and we can apply to our lives, we're going to ask the exact same question here. Let's look at the best. And you're going to actually write a response paper on it, looking at the best relationship that you have encountered, whether it's in the movies, whether it's someone you know well, whether it's your own relationship. And finally, and we're only going to get that, unfortunately, next by Thursday, I know this is disappointment, how do we attract love to our lives? Can you wait till Thursday, or should we start with the end? How do we bring, and that doesn't just apply to people who are not in a relationship, it also applies to people in a relationship. How can we make that love grow even more? You know, love is like happiness. You can never have enough of it. You can always be happier. The relationship can always be better. And we'll talk about, is there such a thing as a perfect relationship, or is it a myth? Let me put this a bit in the context of things that we've already discussed throughout the course. So remember, for your week on goal setting, what you read was about self-concordant goals. And you read about Desi and Ryan's theory of self-determination. Desi and Ryan talk about the three basic needs that each person, no matter where he or she lives, has, the three universal needs. The need for autonomy, for feeling that we are free to choose and that we do choose what we're doing. The need for self-efficacy, the need for confidence, and finally, the need for relatedness, for relationships, for social support, for social interactions. We've already talked to a great extent about autonomy. This is what we talked when we talked about goal setting. This is what it means to do what you really, really want to do with your life. Identify what you find meaningful, identify what you find pleasurable, and what you're good at, and then finding the overlap. This is about autonomy. We're going to talk about it some more next week. We talked about self-efficacy, about confidence in our lecture on beliefs as self-fulfilling prophecies. We're going to talk about it a lot more next week when we talk about self-esteem. What we haven't talked about much is the third component of a fulfilling life, the need for relationships. A person to be happy, to lead a rich life, must have relationships. Let's revisit a study that we've spoken about during the first couple of weeks of the class. The study by Diner and Seligman about extremely happy people. Just to remind you what the study was about, what they looked at was the tip of the stem, the happiest people that they could find. These were college students. And then they compared them to less happy people. Again, not looking at the average, looking at the very happy and the relatively unhappy. What they found was interesting. If you remember, they didn't find that the very happy people were not experiencing as many highs and lows. They were experiencing as many. Sadness, at times depression, and also at times ecstasy and a high, just like the unhappy people were, ups and downs, the vicissitudes of life. But what was the difference? The difference was how long the ups lasted and how long the downs lasted. For the extremely happy people, while they had the same number of highs and lows, their highs and lows lasted. Rather, the lows didn't last long, and the highs lasted a little longer. But overall, their base level was higher. Why? Because they had a different interpretation style. So when the unhappy people had a negative experience, they interpreted it as pervasive and permanent. I'm unhappy, I get a bad grade. I'm no good when it comes to studying, I'm no good at all, and I'm never going to be any good. Pervasive and permanent. Whereas the happy people, the extremely happy people, did feel it down after getting a bad grade. It's natural, human nature, permission to be human. But once they experienced it, they said, okay, so I didn't do well on this exam, I'm going to do better in future exam, and they got over it. It wasn't tainting their entire lives. So that was the main difference. But what led to this difference? The only distinction was the quality of the relationships that they had. Extremely happy people were distinguished by having good relationships. People they could talk to, people they could share their lows as well as their highs. Remember, there's a lot of value. We talked about it when we talked about peak experience and post-peak experience order. There's a lot of value to sharing not only our negative experiences, but also our positive experiences. So these people had, bless you, these people had friends with whom they could share. The important thing, though, in having relationships is to understand who you are. What are your needs in relationships? Because while the need for relationship is universal, what kind of relationships and how many relationships that's particular, that's unique to who you are. Let's revisit another topic that we discussed. The lasagna principle, remember it from the question of happiness? Just to recount, lasagna is my favorite food. Every time I go home, that's what my mom makes for me, a whole large tray of lasagna. But even though it's my favorite food, I wouldn't want to eat it 3 times a day, every day. There is such a thing as too much of a good thing. Similarly with writing, I love to write, but I don't want to write more than 3 to 4 hours a day. I love to teach, but I don't want to teach 8 hours a day. I love spending time with the people who are most dear to me, with my family. But I also want to do other things rather than spend all day, every day with them. Quantity, in other words, affects quality. The same applies to relationships. We all need relationships. We all want relationships. The question is, how much of it do we want? And for every person, it is different. And it is important to make the distinction here between extroverts and introverts. Now, extroverts and introverts vary, first of all, on the number of relationships that they need and want, and the amount of time that they spend within these relationships. So whereas an extrovert would want, say, to have 100 friends, an introvert would want to have 3 friends. An extrovert may want to spend 12 hours of the day with other people. An introvert may want to spend 2 hours of the day with other people. I want to elaborate and go a little bit off on a tangent here, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about extroversion and introversion. So many of you know, whether you're an introvert or extrovert or ambivert, somewhere in the middle. Many of you have taken the Myers-Briggs. So it's important to understand and to make a real distinction so that you know yourself and you're able to apply your knowledge to your life. The most important work done on introversion and extroversion was done by Brian Little, who taught you. Anyone took Brian Little when he was here? Okay, so a couple of you. So he's done work on traits. And one of the 5 traits is extroversion or introversion. And here is what he found. So the research on introversion and extroversion shows that we all have an optimal level of cognitive arousal. Optimal level of cognitive arousal. Introverts, their base level of cognitive arousal is higher than the optimal level. The extroverts, it's lower. It seems counterintuitive, right? Because introverts are much quieter, extroverts are out there. But think about it this way. Why are extroverts always out there? Because they need extra stimulation in order to get to the optimal level of arousal. Why do introverts need to be alone so much of the time? Because being around many people, there's an overload. It's too much. And they need to manage the levels of arousal so that they're lower. Which is why extroverts need a lot of relationships a lot of the time to reach this optimal level of arousal, versus introverts need fewer relationships. But here is the question. What if you're an introvert, but you want to do things, you really, really want to do things that are more associated with extroversion? Or you're an extrovert, and you want to do things that are more associated with introversion. For instance, you're an extrovert and you need to study for an exam. So yeah, one thing you could do is study in groups, but it's very difficult to read in groups. You need to do the readings too, right, extroverts? What if you're an introvert though, and you decide when you're 21 that what you really, really want to do with your life is teach? Does that mean not doing it? Does that mean not doing the reading if you're an extrovert? Not necessarily. However, and this is the key point here for introverts and extroverts, you need to understand that you pay a price for it. You pay a price when you go out of your first nature. This is your first nature, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. You're born with it. It's genetic. But you can act out of nature. Right now, what I'm doing is acting out of my first nature. I feel much more comfortable in office hours, one-on-one, or sitting in front of my computer and writing. However, what I really, really want to do with my life is teach, and therefore I'm here. And here is the key point with Brian Little's research. Yes, we can act according to our second nature. An introvert can act like an extrovert. But then what he or she needs is what Brian Little calls a restorative niche. A restorative niche. So right after lecture, as you know, I have my office hours, one-on-one with people. After I lecture, I often meditate. I need my fix of solitude. If you're an extrovert and you study by yourself, what you need to do after is to get your restorative niche, which could mean for you going out with your friends on senior night, hanging out with people. If we don't have enough restorative niche, whether we're introverts or extroverts, we pay a high price, which comes in the form of burnout, which is a much more prolonged unhappiness, sadness, and after a while, depression. Know thyself, know what you want, what your needs are, and even if you want to do something that's out of your first nature, do it, that's fine, if it's part of your mission. But at the same time, remember, you need the restorative niche. I just had a conversation with one of the teaching fellows here when I was giving a workshop, and we were talking about the generals, which we both took a few years ago, and I said to her, you know, studying for the generals was a real high for me. I would study most of it, you know, read, just do the reading by myself. And she said it was a nightmare for her. She's an extrovert, I'm an introvert. Every night after studying for the generals during the day, she had to go out. Every night after studying the whole day, I was very content spending time with my family. Know thyself and then be thyself. Act according to your nature. Identify these restorative niches. This is when we refuel. And it's different for each person. There is no right refueling. But whether it's 100 people or whether it's 3 people, we all have the need for intimate relationships. The psychologist Fordyce identified this as the most important component of a fulfilling life, having an intimate relationship. David Meyer, one of the fathers, one of the pillars of the positive psychology network. There are few stronger predictions of happiness than a close, nurturing, equitable, intimate, lifelong companionship with one's best friend. What he's describing here is romantic love. What is romantic love? I'm going to give a definition now that's basically a collection of definitions. It's taken from Nathaniel Brandon's work. He has a wonderful book called The Psychology of Romantic Love, from the work of David Myers, from the work of John Gottman, who we're going to talk about probably next time. This is a definition. It's not the right definition. It's a definition so that we're on the same page. An intimate physical, spiritual, emotional attachment between two people, a deep friendship with a passion. Let me unpack this definition. Here are some of its components, necessary. None of them in itself is sufficient, but they're all necessary in order to make up a romantic relationship. First of all, physical intimacy. Romantic love is not about a platonic relationship. There has to be the physical component. Most often, though not always, certainly not necessarily so before marriage, it means sex. Sex at its highest is love made concrete, which is why we talk about making love. Sex is about unity of mind and body. While sex, making love, an intimate physical relationship is a component of romantic love, it is not a sufficient component. Mutual respect and admiration. And we're going to talk a lot about this in the next class, how important it is not just to hold your partner in high esteem, but to hold them in the highest esteem, even higher than they hold themselves. Because that is the number one predictor of successful relationships. To what esteem do we hold our partner? It's also a deep friendship. What does that mean? It means sharing our deepest yearnings, our deepest fears. It means, in the words of David Schnark, it's about being known. And true friends know each other. And again, look, the word know is used for physical love, to know someone, and also for spiritual, for cognitive love as well. It's a spiritual connection. They're soulmates. There is the component of equality there, which is a necessary component of romantic relationships. This is an important one which we in our culture, to a great extent, not fully, but to a great extent, take for granted. But if you look at human history, there was very little of equality. Women have been traditionally oppressed in most cultures, most times. Even today, most cultures, there is no equality between the sexes. I'm saying it for two reasons. First of all, to recognize the importance that this does happen worldwide. The second thing, though, is not to take our relationships for granted. It hasn't been that way all the time. Most people throughout history were deprived of the true emotion, and when they had this emotion, very often it would end in tragedy. It is no coincidence that most stories written, whether it's Shakespeare or Euripides, most of the stories that were told about love had tragic endings. A lot of it is because there was no equality. Robert Sternberg, who was at Yale, now is a dean at Tufts University, talks about the three components necessary for love: intimacy, passion, and commitment. All three have to be in place, and we're going to elaborate on them later on. These are the components of a happy marriage. These are the components of a happy relationship that you're having now, perhaps, or that you would like to have now before you get married. Let me show you one person's definition of marriage.
Look, this is marriage. You wake up in the morning and she's there. You come home at night and she's there. You eat, she's there. You go to sleep, there. And I know that sounds like a bad thing. But but it's not. It's not. Not if it's the right person. Then it's good. It's good. It's really, really good.
I would like a minute for rebuttal.
Let me move on to some myths and facts about relationships. Again, probably the most misunderstood topic, even within psychology, because many people impose their wants, their desires, and are not very objective about this topic. But fortunately, there are some great books. Some of them are listed in your recommended reading list at the end. Recommend every article there and every book there. So what are some of the myths and facts? Let's begin with this. Is true love about self-sacrifice, or is true love about self-interest? Should I love and be loved from a sense of duty, or, God forbid, out of selfishness? Well, let's look at what self-sacrifice or self-interest is. Let's move away a little bit from the very loaded notion of love. And let's go to teaching. Here people can think about the topic a little bit more rationally than they can about love. Let me draw for you two scenarios. First scenario, imagine this. Imagine that I hate teaching. I also hate getting up in the morning and preparing for my lectures, but I drag myself out of bed every morning, go on Psych Info, excruciatingly painful, go on Google, get some images from there, don't enjoy the preparation, and then I come up and talk to the class, and the 80 minutes feel like 80 days. But I go on and I do it. Why do I do it? Because I think positive psychology is important, and I feel a sense of duty to share this topic with other people. I don't like it, I'm not happy about it, but I do it anyway. I'm sacrificing. Good person, right? Well, let's look at another scenario. I love positive psychology and I love teaching. I can't wait to get up in the morning. Just get to my computer, go on Psych Info, read the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, go on Google Image, find pictures, write the lecture, come to class. I can't wait till Tuesday and Thursday, because that's when I get to share with you the things that I care about most. Which teacher would you rather have? A teacher who's here out of a sense of duty, who feels like he or she has to be here, or a teacher who wants to be here more than anything else in the world? As you know, I run programs for at-risk population. And I looked for teachers to help me do it. The first prerequisite was that the people who were going to be teachers, and I got Harvard students, was that they wanted to do this more than anything else in the world. In other words, they wanted to do it. In other words, and let me whisper this, they did it selfishly, for selfish reasons. That sounds terrible to many, many people. Why? Because in our culture, doing the things that we love to do, that we're passionate about, has been equated with immoral. Why? Because many things, many bad things in the world were committed in the name of selfishness, which were negative. However, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Selfishness in and of itself is not good or bad. Just like electricity, it's not good or bad. It is. Now, you can use electricity for good things, for light, or you can use it to electrocute people, for ill. Electricity in and of itself is not good or bad. How we use it is what makes it good or bad. The same with our internal desires, with our wants, with our needs. We can use it for good or for ill. Now, if you look at all the great teachers, they taught because that's the thing that they wanted to do most. Look at some of my role models here, who do not perceive their teaching as sacrifice because both students and teachers end up losing. Marva Collins, that's what she wants. She's the reason I teach. That's what she wants to do every day. She wants to go out there and make a difference in people's lives. Is that a bad thing that she loves to teach? No, it's the most important thing that happened to her and to thousands of others whose lives she touched. Brian Palmer, how many people took his class last year or the year before? Okay, very few. It was quite a popular class here. Great teacher. That's what he wants to do. He wants to teach. This is Brian Little, whose work I discussed earlier. Phenomenal teacher. Phenomenal. Very passionate about what he does. Michael Sandel. Passionate about teaching. Loves to teach. Maria Tatar, whom I had a crush on as an undergrad. Did I just say that out loud or no? Okay. You know, walking into her class was like entering a fairy tale. She teaches fairy tales. Take her class, she's great. She loves to teach. She likes doing what she's doing. The same applies to relationships, even more so to relationships. Again, two scenarios. What relationship would you like to be in? One in which your partner is there with you because she or he feels sorry for you, because they feel like it's their duty to be with you, because you need them. Or someone who would like to be with no other person but you, who loves you, who cares about you. You know, I often talk to my wife, you know, and we talk about this, and I say to her, I love you selfishly, and I want her to love me selfishly too. Again, selfishness has gotten a negative connotation in our culture. Why, to a great extent, it's what I discuss in my book when I talk about Kantian morality, where he says that if we act according to our inclination, the activity cannot be moral. At best, it can be amoral. But that doesn't work in relationships. It doesn't work in anything that we do, whether we go into investment banking or whether we go and work in a homeless shelter. The world needs people who do things that they want to do. Elaine Hatfield did research on relationships, and what she found was that the healthiest relationship, long-term sustainable relationships, are ones where there is perceived equity, where both sides feel like they're getting something from the relationship. Now, the perceived equity doesn't necessarily have to be in terms of how much each person makes. This is irrelevant. The perceived equity has to be in the ultimate currency, in the currency of happiness. Both sides have to feel that they're better off as a result of this relationship, that both contribute. Now, not with every transaction, okay, tit for tat, I just did this for you. Now, I just cleaned the fridge, you need to do the dishes. Certainly not that way. But overall, there has to be a sense of equity in the relationship where both sides feel that they're better off for it. That doesn't mean that there are no compromises in relationships, and it certainly doesn't mean that you don't stand by your loved one when he or she is in need. Far from it. You see, the great thing about relationships is that when you're in love, yourself expands. The I adds to another I and it becomes a we. As Nathaniel Brandon says, this is the great complement of love, that our self-interest expands to encompass our partner. So of course I'll compromise. Of course I'll stand by my loved one. Why? Because that's true love. Now, will I work hard for students? Absolutely. Do I invest a lot of time in my lectures? Absolutely. But I don't kid myself. I don't tell myself I'm doing it out of a sense of duty. It wouldn't be fair to me, nor would it be fair to you. You deserve better. And it certainly applies to relationships. Because what that leads to is a win-win. If in a relationship, one of the sides or both of the sides are sacrificing, both are losing. There is unhappiness in the long run for both partners. Another myth and fact. So, is love just a fiction? I mean, is love really only in the movies, in the poems, in books, or does it really exist? This is an important question, you see, because many people who have had relationships end up believing that true love only exists in movies. Why? Because who can match the true love between Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart? The eternal love. Or who can reach the heights of the love between Kelly McGillis and Tom Cruise? Love that takes your breath away. Exactly my sentiments. Who can match the transcontinental connection between Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks? And finally, who can actually experience the love with the Prime Minister or with Hugh Grant? Does true love really exist? You see, because when we look at these, when we look at these relationships, we see larger than life people on the larger than life screen. And we begin to believe that it's unattainable. Now, movies, art, literature, in general, have a very important role to play. They do show us what life can be like. Aristotle said that fiction is more important than history because history shows us what life is, whereas fiction shows us what life can and ought to be. This is the importance of art. This is the importance of the movies, but there is also a problem there. And the problem is that it depicts relationships that are often, to many people, unattainable. And when we ask ourselves this question, we very often come to a conclusion that it doesn't. And self-help books very often reinforce this. Here is something that Leo Buscaglia, who was a professor at USC and has written many self-help books, here is something that he has to say. Now, Leo Buscaglia was the first self-help book that I read. It's called Living, Loving, and Learning. It's a wonderful book. He's an important scholar. Look what he writes about love. Perfect love is rare indeed. For to be a lover will require that you continually have the subtlety of the very wise, the flexibility of the child, the sensitivity of the artist, the the understanding of the philosopher, the acceptance of the saint, the tolerance of the scholar, and the fortitude of the certain. Beautiful, right? Beautiful and extremely harmful. Who can attain this? Anyone here, hands up, who can fulfill these requirements? No? Okay. Who can live up to this, to these expectations? But when we read this and we say, wait a minute, I'm not this way. My last three boyfriends or girlfriends weren't that way. Kelly McGillis and Tom Cruise maybe were that way in the film, but I know that they're not really that way. Well, maybe Tom Cruise is, but... So, sorry. I have an issue with Tom Cruise I need to share with you. My wife thinks he's the hottest man alive, so that's why every opportunity that I get, I talk about him, yeah. So, perfect love does not exist. Not anywhere. Not here, in this room, not at Harvard, not in Cambridge, not anywhere in the world. And the problem is that if we think it exists, we can spend our entire life searching for it and experiencing frustration after disappointment, and more frustration and more disappointments. And also, I wouldn't want to be on the receiving end of such expectations. I don't want my wife to be with or to think that she can find a saint. I want her to be with a human being. Imperfect, all too human. But true love does exist. And that is the key point, because we do see real people, real human beings in relationships, happy relationships. In fact, research shows that you're more likely to be extremely happy if you're in a relationship, in a long-term marriage, than if you're not. That doesn't mean they're not extremely happy people who are not married and are very happy, or people who are married and are extremely unhappy. But overall, true love does exist. But then comes another myth and fact. Many people believe, and for good reason, that love wanes over time. So yes, you have your honeymoon, you're together for a month, 2 months, 2, 3 years, and it's wonderful. It's terrific. You're the happiest you'd ever been. But then over time, inevitably, love wanes. And what do we have to prove that? 67% of divorces, 33% remaining percent who don't divorce are not always happy. Very often unhappy, but remain there for various reasons. Kids, a sense of duty, not believing that they can find something better, because true love doesn't exist, and love wanes inevitably over time. But does it? The error that people who argue that love wanes over time make is that they mistake between lust and love. Let me make this distinction and illustrate it through an experiment that I ran. So I did a sophomore tutorial before teaching this class. I did a sophomore tutorial on positive psychology. I always like to teach a seminar before I teach the lecture course. And I posed the question, and this is serious research here, posed the question to my sophomore tutorial class. And I asked them, who is the fairest of them all? And this was rigorous research. I want to publish it in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. But before I do, I want to share with you the results. And these are my co-authors on this study. It was Lucy Grayson, Ebony Hazel, Lisa Leroux, Marion Mahoney, Savi Sepa and Crystal Smith. Six of them and me, seven serious scholars, debating this important question. Do you remember that when we talked about it? Very important topic. Now, who did they choose? Not Tom Cruise. Who did they choose? First, the man. Here he is, the fairest of them all, standing outside Troy, telling Helen that he'll be right over. And he wasn't horsing around. Now, who is the fairest woman of them all? Some of you saw it before. Those who didn't see, do you want to guess? Not Angelina. No, sorry. Catherine Zeta-Jones. Good guess, but no. What was that? Marvel Collins. She was my vote, but I was voted down. My second vote, my wife, was also voted down. But the winner, Halle Berry. Now, here she is, holding a gun and telling Adrian Brody that if he comes a step closer, she'll shoot him because she prefers men from the Hasty Puddings. Now imagine this. Imagine that your boyfriend was Brad Pitt, or whoever your Achilles heel is. So bad. And he was your boyfriend, and he declared his eternal love for you. He said, I'm not interested really in Jennifer Aniston. You know that already, though. I'm really not interested in Angelina Jolie. I'm interested in you, sweetheart. Darling. My love, you are the root, the bud of the bud. You set the stars apart. Now, not only does he look like this Greek god, he also has all the qualities that we talked about earlier, that Leo Buscaglia said, of the scholar, the saint, the lover, your ideal perfect man. And you get into this relationship, and it's amazing. No armor can stop you when you see him after a day of work. And you live lustily ever after. Right? No. Well, let's take the other example. Halle Berry comes to you and she says, really, I'm not interested in Adrian Brody. I'm not even interested in Hasty Pudding men. I'm interested in you, my darling, and you alone. Will you spend the rest of your life with me? And she also has these same qualities that Leo Buscaglia talked about. And no gun can stop you after a day of work when you see her. Or for that matter, any woman who is your superhero. You live lustily ever after, right? Maybe not. Because you know what? 3 years go by, and you're living with the man on the left, the woman on the right, or both of them, whatever your inclination is. I'm covering all my bases here, as you can see. But let's say you do live with them and 3 years go by. Every night is an adventure. Every night is an odyssey, and a pleasurable one. What's going on today? Can you tell me? I guess maybe the movies, art. I'm trying my luck here, but I think I'll stay to psychology. So 3 years go by after you make love to them day in and day out. And then another woman or man come to your room and they're standing there, someone you find moderately attractive, you know, no Greek god or goddess to you, but someone you find moderately attractive. Who do you think you will find more sexually arousing? In all likelihood, the new person. Why? Because we seek novelty. Because, remember what we talked about earlier, we are change detectors. We get used to the norm, to what's going, to the usual, to the day-to-day. It becomes the mundane, the obvious, the taken for granted. Daryl Bem, Cornell University, exotic becomes erotic. So that even if we have our ideal archetype, over time, lust, the pure physical aspect of sex, and I'm emphasizing the purely physical aspect of sex, is not as powerful as it would be with someone who is moderately attractive to us, but is novel. Robert Sternberg, when he was doing research at Yale, found that relationships over the years move from initially passionate, consummate, to more companionate. Doesn't mean that people who are in relationship for 40 years don't have sex, but it's not the same kind of sex they had on the first date in the back of the car. No comments, please, from the audience. So, bad news, right? What does this say about long-term relationships? It's not bad news, it's realistic news. Again, this class is not about portraying a Pollyannish world as we want it to be. It portrays reality as it is. This is the fact. The question is, what do we do with this fact? And there is a problem here because, to a great extent, this fact explains the very high levels of infidelity in our culture throughout the ages, not just today. Today, simply, there's more equality or closer to equality between the sexes, but it's been out there from time immemorial. It also explains, to some extent, divorce. In the past, divorce was frowned upon. People weren't doing it. They remained in the relationship out of a sense of duty to whomever it was. But today, when there is a permission to leave a relationship, 67% in this country choose to leave it. So is that bad news? Not necessarily. Not necessarily if we look at the tip of the stem. Because we do see relationships where sex life does improve over time. In fact, an interesting research in this topic, sex life in general actually improves over the years of marriage. People who have been married for a long time may not jump on each other the back of the car, but their sex life is actually better and gets better over the years. Not for everyone. Many people choose to divorce partially because of that. for many people, their life actually improves over time. And for many people, love does grow over the years. The important question that we ask is how. Let's look at this tip of the stem. Let's look at these relationships where love is great, where love is satisfying, where after 20 or 30 years in the marriage, people, the partners are even more in love with one another than they were at the beginning. How does that happen? We're going to talk about it a lot next time, and even more so when we talk about self-esteem. You know why? Because love grows in relationships in which the individuals grow. Nathaniel Brandon puts it beautifully. He says, the more independent we become, the more interdependent we can be. The more independent, in other words, the more who we are, we can become, the stronger self we can cultivate, the better our relationships become. That's a very important point, because very often people think, well, let's work on being together. Let's work on our couplehood by being more interdependent. And how do we do it? Let's work more, do more things together. Yes, that's important. But the most important component is to cultivate yourself. Self-concept clarity that we have discussed. Self-esteem that we'll discuss next time. The most important book written on this topic, well, there are two very important books. One is Nathaniel Brandon's The Psychology of Romantic Love. The second one is called Passionate Marriage by David Schnark, S-C-H-N-A-R-C-H. And what he writes about, he says that love at its best usually comes when you're 50 or 60 years old. Why? Because he says love and sex, and he doesn't differentiate between the two. Again, they're all part of a passionate relationship, is for grown-ups. So while we can have great sex and great lovemaking when we're 18, we can have much, much better love and sex when we're 55. Counterintuitive. It's not what our culture tells us, right? Men peak at what, 24? Women peak at 33, whatever? The problem with this research is that for many people it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then they say, well, I'm 40 years old, or my relationship can't be as great as the one I had when I was 20. And we don't like when there is a disconnect between what's inside and what's outside, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it hurts many relationships. The most succinct statement by David Schnark, capturing this essence of how love can improve and does improve, for people who learn to differentiate themselves, to become more independent, more certain of themselves, more self-assured, knowing what they want to do as opposed to what they have to do, identifying their self-concordant goals. These are the ways we become more independent, more ourselves. And that helps us become more interdependent. David Schnark talks about the importance of going into a relationship in order to be known, as opposed in order to be validated. To be known in a relationship, to be open there, out there, not to be ashamed of who one is, not to be ashamed of one's fantasies. That's one of the reasons why sex can improve and does improve over time, because we feel more and more comfortable with our partner. More and more comfortable to be who we are, not to hide, to uncover and discover our deepest self. David Schnark, cellulite and sexual potential are highly correlated. This is not what we hear. This is not what we hear, because we hear that love necessarily wanes over time. Why? Because people lack to distinguish between love making, which has a physical, surely, component, but also cognitive and spiritual component to it. which influenced the quality of sex even more than just the purely physical initial arousal that comes with novelty and certainly changes over the years. Here's another big question, myth and fact. Most people believe that the most difficult thing in the world is finding love. I need to find the one right relationship, the one lid, the perfect match. There is a misconception there. You see, and some of this misconception comes from the movies. Because what do we see in the movies? That the most difficult thing in the movies is when people look for one another, whether it's Seattle to New York, and they go through trials and tribulations, or whether it's in a far out place and they go through trials and tribulations, and finally they come together and they kiss at the end of the movie. Those of you have seen In Her Shoes, it has that. They kiss at the end of the movie, and then the screen drops and they live happily ever after. You know what the problem is with that model, with the movies? Is that movies end where love begins. They kiss, and maybe they live happily ever after, but the most difficult part of a relationship is not the finding. It is the cultivating. It takes hard work to sustain a long-term relationship. Hard work that doesn't mean painful work, can be the most rewarding, potentially the most rewarding work in the world, but it takes work. The living happily ever after is the difficult part. That's when effort is required. That's where a lot of thinking is required. That's what we're going to talk a lot about and what a lot of your reading is about. You see, because the one right person theory, I just need to find him or her and then we'll live happily ever after, it's simply not true. It's not true because nothing, no initial conditions promise a relationship that's sustainable, that will last, and that will be happy. Nothing. Moreover, there isn't just one person. There are, 6 billion in the world? There is more than one right person for each and every one of us. So what's unique about the person with whom we choose to spend our life, or our junior year, or freshman week, or pre-frosh weekend? What's special about that is that we choose to cultivate it or not. This is what makes a relationship special. Not the fact that there is just one right person for me, but that I've chosen to spend my life to get to know that person, to know fully, and to be known, not to be validated, to be known. This is what makes unique relationships, and this is what makes relationships last. We're going to talk about how we make it last, how we make it work, because there are actually things that researchers have looked at, whether it's John Gottman, whether it's David Schnark. One of the people who's the most important, one of the most important researchers in this topic is John Gottman. John Gottman became famous when he was able to predict with 94% accuracy which relationships will last and which will end in divorce. 94% accuracy by observing the partners interact. That's remarkable. We don't find this kind of predictive power in the social sciences. Here is the research that he did. He did research on conflict within relationships. You see, one of the myths that most people have is that the ideal relationship is one that is conflict-free. This is our gold standard. This is the optimum. We want to get to a stage where we don't disagree with our partners, where we live in perfect harmony. Best relationship, right? Wrong. Why is it wrong? First of all, because what Gottman found is that there is no one right relationship. There are different relationships. Some relationships, they interact, they have some conflict, and it's quiet conflict. They just turn around and do their own thing before they get back together again. Other relationships, it's volatile. They scream at one another and then make love after. It varies. There is no one right relationship. But what is common to all the relationships, and here is the key point, they all have some conflict within them. That is the key issue. This is the key point that Gottman talks about. In fact, he was able to identify, and this is how we can predict whether relationships will last over a long time. He was able to identify the optimal level of conflict. And what he said is that there needs to be a certain ratio between positive experiences in a relationship and negative experiences in a relationship. In other words, between good things, reinforcement, wonderful things, and on the other hand, disagreements, fights, all civil. We're not talking about abusive relationships here, but there has to be conflict. And the ratio that he found was that it has to be 5-1 in favor of positivity. In other words, for every disagreement or fight or negative exchange, there has to be 5 positive ones. He elaborates on it much more in his book, which is in your recommended list. This is important research because what he's saying is that if we look at relationship quality on this axis, and on this axis we see the ratio of positivity, he says that the graph looks something like this. Here would be the 5-1 ratio. Here would be a higher ratio, and that's not good for the quality of the relationship. Here would be a low ratio, more negativity, and that's also not good. Now this, pretty straightforward. I can understand why this is not good. But why is too much positivity relative to negativity not good? Why? Because there is no perfect relationship. There is no such thing as a perfect relationship. And if there is no conflict in the relationship, it means that the partners are avoiding. It means that there is no psychological safety within the relationship, where partners feel comfortable airing their disagreements. It means that there is no learning, because you need to learn to fail or you fail to learn. The healthy relationship doesn't look like a straight line from A to B. It has its ups and downs, necessarily. It's part of growing. And just like when we get sick, our body, if it's not a too severe a sickness, actually gets stronger as a result because of our immune system. We get immunized by being injected by the actual bacteria that causes this illness. The same with conflict. It immunizes the relationship. It makes it better. It makes it stronger. It makes it more likely to last over time. So it's a myth that the ideal relationship is one without any conflict, because conflict actually strengthens us. I want to show you an example of a relationship where initially when you look at it, you would think, you know, this can't be love. But if you understand Gottman's research, you may understand that, well, maybe, I don't know. I haven't actually interviewed the partners that you will see in a minute. Maybe there is true love there. And looks may be misleading. Here they are. And they lived happily ever after. See you on Thursday.